after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Dave DeForest reporting. Families and colleagues of three French police officers killed in last week's terrorist attacks in Paris paid their final respects today. French President François Hollande stood before the flag-draped coffins and praised their heroism. Funerals were also held today in Jerusalem for four Jewish victims of last week's murders, as we hear from Robert Berger.
The bodies of the four French Jews killed in the terrorist attack on a kosher supermarket last Friday in Paris were wrapped in prayer shawls and placed on a podium in front of a large Israeli flag. Thousands of mourners joined Israeli leaders at the official state funeral in Jerusalem in a show of solidarity. Robert Berger for VOA News, Jerusalem.
Bulgarian authorities confirmed the arrest of Fritz Joly Joachim, a French citizen wanted on terrorism-related and kidnapping charges. A cartoon image of the Muslim prophet Muhammad will be on the cover of the next issue of the satirical magazine Charlie Hebdo, which comes out Wednesday. In a preview release this week, Muhammad is seen holding a sign saying, "I am Charlie," under the headline, "All is forgiven." Ukrainian authorities say 10 civilians were killed today when a shell or missile hit a bus south of the separatist-controlled city of Donetsk. They say 13 people were injured when pro-Russian rebels fired a rocket launcher at a military checkpoint near the town of Volnovakha, and one of the missiles struck the bus. An Egyptian appeals court says ousted President Hosni Mubarak and his two sons will get a retrial in an embezzlement case that earned them jail sentences last year. The court in Cairo announced its decision today, a move that rolls back the only remaining conviction against him. Pope Francis has highlighted the need for justice, healing, and unity in Sri Lanka, where he arrived today for the start of a week-long trip to Asia. The Pope spoke at the international airport in Colombo, saying Sri Lanka needs to pursue the truth of what happened in its long civil war. He said a rebuilding in the country must include a respect for human rights. Speaking in Colombo at a meeting of leaders from various religions, the Pope decried the misuse of religion.
In the state of peace, religious belief must never be allowed to be abused in the cause of violence and war.
Pope Francis. Indonesian divers have now retrieved both flight recorders or black boxes from the Air Asia jet that crashed into the Java Sea last month, killing 162 people. Divers today brought up the second black box, the cockpit voice recorder, a day after locating and retrieving the flight data recorder. A top Lord's Resistance Army commander who surrendered to U.S. forces last week will be handed over to the International Criminal Court. A Ugandan army spokesman said in a Twitter message today that Dominic Ongwen will be tried at the ICC in The Hague. The AFP reports that allies of ousted Zimbabwe Vice President Joyce Mujuru are planning a legal fight to regain their influence in the ruling ZANU-PF party. The former ZANU-PF officials say their ouster from party positions was unconstitutional. Scores of party officials were fired last year after being accused of siding with former Vice President Mujuru. Mujuru was accused of plotting to assassinate President Robert Mugabe, a charge she denies. Reuters reports a spokeswoman for the United Nations Human Rights Office is calling for a restoration of law and order in Nigeria's northeastern area. The Islamist militant group Boko Haram has killed thousands in a five-year rebellion in Nigeria. Ravina Shamdasani spoke at a news briefing in Geneva.
We urge the government to act swiftly to restore law and order while ensuring that security operations are conducted in line with international law and full respect for human rights.
There are news reports today that Egyptian Islamic leaders are denouncing the publication of a cartoon depicting the Prophet Muhammad in the new issue of the French magazine Charlie Hebdo. While rejecting violence against the magazine, the Islamic leaders describe the latest publications as a provocation that will upset Muslims around the world. From the VOA News Center in Washington, I'm Dave DeForest. That's a look at the latest news.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yais Wuhib. And coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight...
The United Nations says attacks by Boko Haram militants in far northeastern Nigeria have forced more than 11,000 people into neighboring Chad and may have displaced 150,000 overall since seizing the town of Baga and nearby villages on January 3.
That's VOA's Lisa Schlein reporting from Geneva. Details coming up.
Also, China announces that more than 200 army medical workers have left for Liberia and Sierra Leone to help fight the Ebola outbreak.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Senegal, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, the United Nations says attacks by Boko Haram militants in far northeastern Nigeria have forced more than 11,000 people into neighboring Chad and may have displaced 150,000 overall since seizing the town of Baga and nearby villages on January 3rd. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs spokesman Jens Laerke tells VOA information is sketchy because Baga and the surrounding areas have been inaccessible.
The attacks there in Baga town in Borno State on the 3rd and the 7th displaced an estimated 150,000 people. That's according to the Borno State Emergency Management Agency, because independent access to the area is simply not there at the moment. So this figure has yet to be verified by the UN.
Laerke says most of the displaced are living with host families in various communities and are receiving assistance from state and local agencies, as well as the Nigerian Red Cross. The UN Refugee Agency reports 11,320 people have fled to Chad since the attack on Baga. UNHCR spokesman William Spindler says 60% of the refugees are women and children, and 40% are men.
There's also 84 non-accompanied children, and some of them are stranded on an island on Lake Chad called Kangalam Island. There's about 2,000 of them there, and UNHCR is transferring them to the mainland. This is all in Chad, and this transfer has started.
According to some reports, fighting since January 3rd has killed as many as 2,000 people, but the Nigerian military disputes this figure. The government has been conspicuously silent since the attack on Baga, but Monday, Nigerian defense spokesman Major General Chris Olukolade said at least 150 people had been killed. The UN Human Rights Office condemns what it calls the vicious, ruthless attacks against civilians by Boko Haram. Spokeswoman Ravina Shamdasani says it is likely the number of people who have lost their lives is significant.
We haven't been able to verify that. Well, what is clear is that eyewitnesses are saying, one eyewitness was talking about how when he was fleeing, he was tripping on bodies the whole way. So clearly, a large number of people were killed.
Shamdasani says the deliberate targeting of civilians is prohibited by international law. The UN agency is urging the Nigerian government to act swiftly to restore law and order. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Government officials in Cameroon say the country's military has stopped an attempt by suspected Boko Haram militants to seize a military base at Kolofata on the border with Nigeria's Borno State. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from the Cameroonian capital, Yaoundé.
Cameroon's Minister of Communication, Issa Chiruma Bakari, has told state radio that hundreds of suspected Boko Haram fighters attacked the Cameroonian military base at Kolofata. He quotes Cameroonian Defense Minister Mebengo as saying at least 143 of the attackers were killed, with others retreating to surrounding villages.
Taking advantage of a particularly heavy cloud in this period of the year, the assailants, who were hundreds of them, made it up to the border and tried to surprise our defense forces, and fierce fighting started during more than 5 hours near the military camp and over other strategic points of the locality. Our defense forces succeeded in neutralizing the attackers on the first front line by a systematic bombing of their positions, resulting in the setback of the assailants towards the border with Nigeria.
Cameroon's defense minister, Edgar Aleme Benga, says his military's response to the attack was swift.
Plus que par le passé, nos forces sont déterminées, engagées.
He says our soldiers are more determined than ever to fight Boko Haram wherever they attack us in northern Cameroon. The military has the support of all the Cameroonian people, he says. Abdulaziz Mustafa, a municipal councillor in Kolofata, said in a telephone interview that there were at least 400 of the assailants in their locality. He says three Cameroonians were seriously wounded while one soldier was shot dead on the spot. Many assailants were killed. I do not know the exact number. All I know is that many of them attacked the base of Cameroon's military in Kolofata, he adds. Kolofata resident Usmaila Malam also confirmed in a telephone interview that he saw the corpse of a Cameroonian soldier and counted at least 10 wounded soldiers who were being rushed to the hospital for treatment. He says not only Boko Haram fighters, but civilians were killed in the shooting before the invaders retreated to surrounding villages where they are taking cover in the midst of villagers. He says many people invaded the base of the defense forces. They tried hard to seize the military base, but did not succeed. The spokesperson of Cameroon's military, Colonel Didier Bajek, says he does not understand how Boko Haram continues to get weapons after incurring heavy damage from Cameroon's military since the border war started in May of last year.
Dans le cas du Boko Haram, l'on n'a pas encore fini de décrypter les tenants et les aboutissants.
He says there are many issues concerning this Boko Haram group that they still don't understand. How is it that they continue to be resilient despite the enormous damage they have suffered? What justifies these multiple attacks on Cameroon? Last week, Cameroon's President Paul Biya calls for international support and a coordinated response against Boko Haram. President Biya said the African Union and other international organizations should have proposed a global response to this global terrorism threat, insisting that the distance that separated a country from the conflict zone was not a sign of safety. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
Thirteen minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. The head of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention spoke in Washington about the West African Ebola epidemic. The outbreak has killed nearly 8,400 people, with nearly all of the more than 21,000 cases in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. Dr. Tom Frieden addressed a congressional policy breakfast meeting on Africa.
The Ebola epidemic has now been going on in West Africa for more than a year. Fundamentally, we have an epidemic that stretches across three countries, that's killed thousands of people, that has had an outsized impact on the health sector and on society. This has been a devastating epidemic, and it's been unique. It is the world's first epidemic of Ebola, and it has stretched the world's systems and taught us what more we need to do.
He says the lack of early warning surveillance systems allowed the Ebola virus to quickly spread undetected.
If a year ago we had had surveillance systems in the forest region where the disease emerged, it's quite possible that we could have responded quickly and ended the outbreak long ago, before so many lives and so much devastation happened. And as long as there is a single case in West Africa, the risk of exporting the disease to other countries continues.
The CDC chief returned last month from West Africa and gives an updated evaluation of the response efforts. The initial response to the Ebola epidemic on the national and international levels has been sharply criticized as too slow.
I saw amazing progress. The difference was really night to day. Strikingly different, but nowhere near out of the woods. Very easy for this to get out of control. Guinea has come close to controlling it on two different occasions, and maybe they got a little bit lax. They dropped the ball a bit, and it came roaring back. That importance of following every single case until we get to zero is absolutely essential. For the Centers for Disease Control, CDC, this is the largest global response in our history. We have today more than 200 of our top disease control specialists, professionals in the region, in fact, most of the places where disease is spreading, in remote rural areas, traveling by canoe, by helicopter, hiking into areas, and working with people from within each of the countries to stop the outbreaks.
That's Dr. Tom Frieden of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention speaking today in Washington.
China has announced that more than 200 army medical workers have left for Liberia and Sierra Leone to help fight the Ebola outbreak. Officials in Beijing say they will join more than 80 specialists from the Chinese Center for Disease Control who are now serving in Sierra Leone. The Chinese government has donated more than $120 million to combat the West African epidemic. Meanwhile, in Britain, the Royal Free Hospital in London says the Scottish nurse who was critically ill with the virus has improved. Pauline Cafferty was admitted on January 4th. She contracted Ebola while working for Save the Children in Sierra Leone. And in the U.S., a doctor who survived the virus says he is returning to work in Liberia. Dr. Rick Sakara says he will return to a Monrovia hospital where he contracted the virus. He will treat patients with malaria and diabetes, but not Ebola.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yais Wuhib, 17 past the hour. Here's a recap of our top stories. According to the UN, since Boko Haram seized the town of Baga and nearby villages on January 3rd, close to 150,000 people have been displaced. And China has announced that more than 200 army medical workers have left for Liberia and Sierra Leone to help fight the Ebola outbreak. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on our stories. You can write to us at Africa News Tonight, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue, Southwest Washington, D.C., 20237.
A new study says HIV-positive children are much more likely to die from pneumonia than children who are not infected with the AIDS virus. It's estimated there are more than 3 million children under age 14 living with HIV. The vast majority are in sub-Saharan Africa. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
Researchers say deaths from pneumonia among HIV-positive children could be dramatically reduced by expanding current treatments. Dr. Harish Nair led the study to better understand the scope of the problem. He's with the University of Edinburgh's Center for Population Health Sciences.
We've been working on pneumonia estimates for over a decade now, and we realize that there are no estimates for pneumonia in HIV-infected children. We all know that pneumonia is an important cause of morbidity and mortality in HIV-infected children.
While it was clear pneumonia threatened HIV-positive children, Nair says it was not known just how many were actually affected. The global study his team conducted, the first of its kind, shed light on the problem.
What we see is globally, of the 116 million episodes of pneumonia occurring each year in under five children, 1.4 million episodes are in HIV-infected children, and of the 920,000 deaths from pneumonia in under 5 children, we find there are 88,000 deaths in HIV-infected children.
Africa and South Asia are the worst regions for HIV-positive children dying from pneumonia. Their weakened immune systems put them at greater risk. Pneumonia has been linked to poverty, poor living conditions, and inadequate health services.
To put this into perspective, a child who has HIV and who develops pneumonia has a 36-fold higher risk of dying compared to a healthy child who is HIV uninfected.
The study was commissioned by the World Health Organization and published in the Lancet Infectious Diseases Journal. The findings will be used to develop new care and treatment guidelines. Nair says AIDS drugs keep patients healthier and make them less susceptible to pneumonia. Buddy says while sub-Saharan Africa now has greater access to AIDS drugs, most of them are for adults.
Even now, the antiretroviral coverage in young children remains pretty low. For example, the data for coverage of antiretrovirals in children in under 5 years is not available. The other problem is that the antiretroviral coverage in children across the 0 to 14-year age group remains pretty low. It's about only 29% in these 22 high-priority global action plan countries.
Dr. Nair says opportunistic infections are very common in children with HIV. However, he says only about 30% receive the drug cotrimoxazole. The drug has been shown to lower the overall infection rate, not only for pneumonia, but also for malaria and sepsis. He also says children with HIV should be a top priority when administering the pneumococcal vaccine.
There have been studies which have shown that in HIV-infected children, once you've introduced the pneumococcal vaccine, the incidence of pneumonia decreased sharply.
He adds that diagnosing pneumonia in HIV-positive children needs to be strengthened at the primary care level. Nair also recommends rapidly scaling up antiretroviral therapy for pregnant women and young children with HIV. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
An estimated 150,000 migrant workers remain stranded in Libya 3 years after the fall of the former regime. The International Organization for Migration is working to help the most vulnerable return home. The majority of the migrants are from Sudan, Ghana, Togo, Mali, Burkina Faso, Nigeria, Pakistan, the Philippines, India, and Egypt. They left their home countries for a better life in Libya before the overthrow of Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi. However, IOM says life remains hard for them as security conditions continue to deteriorate. Othman Belbelsi is the chief of mission for IOM Libya. He explained that getting an accurate number of the migrants is very challenging and estimates there are many more in the country than are being reported.
To identify, let me say, the concept of stranded migrants at this stage is a bit complicated because currently we get our information based on direct requests we receive either from the embassies, the concerned embassies of those migrants, or through people who approach our office asking for help. Unfortunately, in Libya, there are no accurate numbers about the migrant workers present in the country, but you can get also an indicator from the people leaving Libya by boat, for example. In 2014, more than 170,000 migrants left by boat to Italy. I believe 90% of them left through Libya. And this will show the large number of migrants being present in the country, which is definitely between 1 and 1.5 million.
You all have ongoing efforts in trying to help these migrants to voluntarily return to their homes. So what type of progress are you making in this area?
We have two programs. One was the voluntary return and reintegration programs, which means upon return to their home country, the migrants will receive also a reintegration package that will allow them to establish a small business. Definitely, the payment is not made in cash. It's in-kind grant upon development of a business plan in coordination with our office in the country of return. And I am in Libya, have been doing this since 2006. The second part is the emergency evacuation, which started since July 2014. Given the deterioration in the security situation, since we were expecting larger numbers to leave the country, we focused more on the movement of those people, only providing the part related to return tickets back home, with very limited number receiving their integration assistance, and those would be qualified as the most vulnerable migrants, mean maybe unaccompanied women, children, people with health issues. We were actually evaluating this on case-by-case basis.
Also, you mentioned earlier that the security situation is deteriorating for them there. So what is life like for them right now?
I believe those migrants are the most affected by the current or ongoing crisis for a number of reasons. One, that they don't have their support network within the community. So if you are a national of the country or a Libyan, you have your family living somewhere else in the country where you can approach them when you need help. Also, people can differentiate between the nationals and non-nationals, which may also lead to some kind of discrimination in many cases. And this mainly depends on the area where you are, how well you are known in this area, but also it can tend to be very complicated when you are in the wrong place at the wrong time. That's why a number of casualties occur. On the other hand, there are no accurate information on the number of migrants. And since there are no accurate information, you cannot tell if some people actually disappear unless this information is referred to you through your referral networks or through the communities.
What are their basic needs at this point that you all are providing for them?
It is complicated for them to decide to go back home. You know, people have invested very much to come to Libya, seeking for a better future or looking for a job, or they have their own plan, which means it is not an easy decision after spending this large amount of money and going through this very tough journey to decide just to go back home. So many of them currently just decided to wait and see what will happen. So some of the support would be to provide direct assistance, which means mainly non-food items. In addition, many of them are willing to return back home, and the return is a costly operation, and there are also huge challenges related to that, mainly the partial closure of the border of neighboring countries, the need of visa procedures, the need to obtain the appropriate documentation for them in coordination with the embassies.
What is being done to help those migrants who are in detention centers?
A number of detention centers decided just to release the migrants because they cannot provide them with food anymore. So some of them were just left out on the streets trying to find their way. And for the limited number of detention centers that still have migrants, IOM and a number of humanitarian agencies are trying to provide the most basic needs, which means food, non-food, and non-food items. And for IOM also, we provide return for those who are willing to return back to their home countries.
That was Othman Belbasi, Chief of Mission for IOM Libya. He spoke with me from Tunis.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Is a public service announcement from VOA Africa.
If you come into contact with the bodily fluids of a person infected with Ebola, you must wash with soap and water immediately. I'm Dr. Conde Greaves. The Ebola virus is only present in the blood, feces, vomit, breast milk, sweat, and semen of people who are seriously ill. The virus must get into your body to infect you. Do not touch your eyes, nose, or mouth, and cover any cuts on the skin. If you are caring for someone who has Ebola, do not handle bedding, towels, or clothes that may be soiled with bodily fluids without gloves. Avoid sexual activity with male survivors of Ebola. Men carry the virus in semen for up to 90 days. Ebola cannot survive for long outside the body. Sunlight, heat, Clorox, and alcohol will kill the virus. Know the facts about Ebola. Knowledge is life.
This was a public service announcement from VOA Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. The UN says since Boko Haram seized the town of Baga and nearby villages on January 3rd, close to 150,000 people have been displaced. Coming up, we'll have music from Senegal, and in our feature segment, South Africa's education system struggling for two decades to overcome entrenched inequalities from the apartheid system. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehia Swuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Happy Tuesday, Sunny.
Happy Tuesday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you have kudos for a Portuguese football star.
Kim, here's a Sunny Side of Sports salute to Cristiano Ronaldo, who for the second year in a row and third time overall has been crowned the world's best footballer. At a gala ceremony in Zurich, Switzerland, the Portugal and Real Madrid star was presented with the FIFA Ballon d'Or trophy. How do you feel, Cristiano?
Amazing. I feel very good. Happy. It was a fantastic night, fantastic trophy. Very proud.
You should be very proud, Cristiano. You've now matched France's Zinedine Zidane and Brazil's Ronaldo, who also won three FIFA Player of the Year awards. And you're now in second place behind Argentina's Lionel Messi, who has won four. Cristiano, were you confident of beating Messi and German goalkeeper Manuel Neuer this time around?
I'm not sure about nothing. I was hope that I have good chance, but the beginning when they mentioned the name, the heart started to beat fast and adrenaline. It's a hard moment, to be honest. But I think I deserve. Neuer deserve too, and Messi. But last year I deserve more, so I'm really pleased for that.
Meanwhile, Germany's Nadine Kessler was real pleased after winning the FIFA Women's Player of the Year award for 2014. Another German, Joachim Löw, was named the FIFA Men's Coach of the Year after leading Germany to the World Cup title in Brazil. And speaking of the World Cup, Colombia's James Rodriguez won FIFA's Best Goal Award for 2014 for a stunning strike against Uruguay during the World Cup. More football news now on the VOA. In Major League Soccer, one of the big recent stories was the reigning champion Los Angeles Galaxy signing Liverpool captain Steven Gerrard to an 18-month contract. The 34-year-old Gerrard is scheduled to join the Galaxy in July, following the end of his season with Liverpool in the English Premier League. Galaxy officials are excited about Gerrard's arrival. The head coach of the Los Angeles Galaxy is Bruce Arena.
Well, he's an outstanding player, and I think his addition would be similar to the addition of David Beckham years ago and Robbie Keane. And he's a very talented player, a great leader, a great professional, and he'll complement our team. How we play exactly, I can't tell you now, but those are good problems to have, and we'll sort all of that out. But I think Stevie's committed here to come and give it 100% and hopefully make our team champions again.
Bruce Arena talks about the Los Angeles Galaxy becoming champions again. The Galaxy defeated the visiting New England Revolution last month, 2-1 in extra time, to lift their record fifth MLS Cup championship. Another Galaxy official excited about the signing of Steven Gerrard is club president Chris Klein.
It's a big signing for our club. And the response has been great. This was, first and foremost, this had to be a move into what he could provide to the team and how he could help us win. And once we got there, it's been big. It's big news. Steven Gerrard is a worldwide name, and we know that. And he fits the profile of the success that we've had with our designated players, and they've helped us to achieve what we've achieved over the past 5 or 6 years. So we're excited about the move. We know that we have a few months until he arrives, so we expect the momentum to build, but very, very happy that we were able to get this done and push it over the finish line and have him sign to LA Galaxy.
It's not just LA Galaxy officials excited about the signing of Steven Gerrard. Los Angeles Lakers basketball star Kobe Bryant had this to say.
What can I say, man? Welcome to Los Angeles. Welcome to La La Land. And hopefully that means bringing another championship to the Galaxy. So I'm sure it will. I'm looking forward to getting down there and watching you do your thing. I've been a fan of yours for a very, very long time, and your versatility and your aggressiveness and your leadership. So welcome to Los Angeles, man. And enjoy and kick some ass in the process. And I'll be down there rooting you on, my man. Peace.
Peace to you, Kobe. Los Angeles Lakers basketball star Kobe Bryant.
This is the voice of America. Washington, D.C.
The voice of America.
Hello, everybody. From that very first broadcast during World War II, and ever since, the voice of America has been the voice of freedom. So on behalf of the American people and the millions around the world who draw hope and strength from your work, thank you all for being the proud and steady voice of America.
Voice of America!
And thank you, President Obama, for your support of the Voice of America. Meanwhile, President Obama has welcomed the National Basketball Association champion San Antonio Spurs to the White House.
In case you didn't know, these are the NBA champion San Antonio Spurs. Now, look, I admit it, I'm a Bulls fan. It's never easy celebrating a non-Bulls team in the White House. That's all I've been able to do. So far. But even I have to admit that the Spurs are hard to dislike. First of all, they're old. And for an old guy, it makes me feel good to see, where's Tim? Tim's got some gray. Since drafting Tim Duncan in 1997, they've won 5 titles. Tim has now won rings 15 years apart, only the second player in history to win titles in 3 different decades. Tim and Tony and Manu have won more playoff games than any trio in NBA history.
Applause at the White House for the NBA champion San Antonio Spurs. The Spurs are here in Washington to play my beloved Washington Wizards later Tuesday night at the Verizon Center Arena. located just a few blocks from our Voice of America headquarters. While the Wizards have the advantage of waving their magical wands at home, where they've won 16 of 20 games this season, recent history favors Tim and Manu and Tony and those NBA champion Spurs. San Antonio has beaten Washington in 17 straight games. Count them, 17 consecutive games. I'll be keeping my fingers crossed and maybe waving my own wand that the Wizards can break that losing streak later tonight. Go Wizards! Overall, Washington has a record of 25 wins and 12 losses, while San Antonio has 23 victories and 15 defeats. In NBA action Monday night, Brandon Jennings had 34 points and 10 assists to help the Detroit Pistons clip the wings of the host Toronto Raptors 114-111. The Pistons won for the ninth time in their past 10 games, and they broke a four-game losing streak against Toronto. And let's give a sunny side of sports shout-out for Toronto's Lithuanian center, Jonas Valanciunas. Jonas scored a career-high 31 points for the Raptors, and he also grabbed 12 rebounds. Another European big man, Nikola Vucevic of the Orlando Magic, also had a big night. Vucevic, who is from Montenegro, scored 33 points and had 11 rebounds as the Magic scored a 121-114 victory over the host Chicago Bulls. Victor Oladipo, whose mother is Nigerian and whose father is from Sierra Leone, also scored 33 points for the Magic. Getting back to Vucevic, this was his NBA best 23rd double-double of the season. And what's a double-double, you ask? Well, that's double figures in two different statistical categories. Nikola Vucevic doing it this NBA season. His magical performance for Orlando included a drive and left-handed dunk over another top European player, the Spaniard Pau Gasol, late in the third quarter. Elsewhere, the Houston Rockets defeated the Brooklyn Nets 113-99 in New York City. The game was marred by a fight between Houston's Dwight Howard and Brooklyn's Kevin Garnett, both veterans in the NBA. Garnett was ejected in the first quarter after headbutting Howard in the face and throwing the ball at him, and Howard received a technical foul after appearing to punch or slap Garnett in the neck. Harden fired in 30 points for the Rockets, who lead the NBA Southwest Division with a record of 27 wins and 11 losses. Taking a quick look at the top of the NBA standings, the Golden State Warriors continue to have the league's best record with 29 wins and only 5 losses. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Yahaeus Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the sunny side of sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the sunny side of sports at 1730 hours UTC right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, parenting issues affecting the African workforce in the face of the coming baby boom. And next, South Africa's education system struggling for two decades to overcome entrenched inequalities from the apartheid system. But first, some music. Here is Vivian Noor of Senegal with Sami Nini.
beauty, ayo, ay. Sama nene Lord Joy, ayo.
Vivian Noor of Senegal with Samanini.
Well, Africa's population is growing, and the United Nations estimates 40% of the world's population will live in Africa by 2050. African economies are also growing, along with the growth in the workforce. But in some countries, the social and economic forces collide on workplace issues like parental leave. While some countries are moving to extend leave, others are having a hard time enforcing the laws they already have. Hillary Hewler in Nairobi takes a look at how parenting issues affect the African workforce in the face of the coming baby boom.
As one of Africa's most vibrant economies, Kenya boasts an impressive body of labor legislation. Many of these laws are quite good, says Ernest Nadome, who works for the Central Organization of Trade Unions. He notes Kenya's laws on parental leave, which date back to 2007, should make it easier for women to balance the needs of work and family.
The lady employee is entitled to 3 months maternity leave. And on top of that, the lady employee also will not forfeit the normal annual leave that other male employees enjoy. And at the same time, when you're on maternity leave, you are entitled to your full benefits.
But many Kenyan women say it doesn't always work out that way. Esther Njau gave birth to her daughter Marie 5 months ago. When she got pregnant, she found her small company only offered 2 months of maternity leave, which, she says, is not uncommon. 2 months wasn't enough for her, so she felt she had no choice but to quit.
Most of the private enterprises in Kenya have a problem with maternity leave. Okay, once you're working in a private enterprise, the rules are made by the owner of the company because he's the director. If he says it's 2 months, if you're not comfortable with it, what do? You just quit.
Not only do most employers not provide the 3 months the law requires, says Njau, but very few will actually pay a woman's salary when she's on leave. And many of Njau's friends have had a harder time than she has. Some have been replaced when they went on maternity leave, while others have simply been fired. This poses a serious dilemma to working women who want children, says Njau.
Should I? Should I not? You're so confused. You're earning well, you're living well, but the moment you get pregnant, you're fired or you're replaced. So that's something that can keep you from getting more kids.
Nadome says that in Kenya, unionized workers are usually more successful in fighting for their rights to parental leave. But most Kenyans are not unionized, and many in the informal sector work without any contracts at all. Throughout Africa, countries have begun to grapple with issues of parenting at work. According to a 2010 report by the International Labour Organization, 82% of the 50 African countries studied now provide at least 12 weeks of maternity leave. Many had recently increased it, and South Africa is now under pressure to increase it even more. Ultimately, says Nadome, denying parental leave can have far-reaching social consequences. Hillary Hewler for VOA News, Nairobi.
The South African government announced this year's graduate exam results reveal a decline in the number of passing students. The nation's education system has struggled for two decades to overcome entrenched inequalities from the apartheid system. The drop in passing students garnered criticism, but the leading South African advocacy group says there's more to it than just numbers. Anita Powell reports from Johannesburg.
More than 600,000 South African high schoolers have been eagerly awaiting this week's announcement of their matriculation exam grades, results that could determine their futures. But they are not the only ones using this vital grade to assess their worth. The matriculation exam results, called matric, reflect on the broader performance of this nation, which has for decades struggled to free its educational system from the legacy of the unequal apartheid regime. This year's matric exams were the first to be taken by students who were educated under a new set of guidelines that aim to improve students' core skills and give teachers more concrete guidance. Here is Basic Education Minister Angie Motshekga announcing the hotly awaited results.
The national pass rate of the class of 2014 is 75.8% and sadly has a drop of 2.5 percentage point. I thought we were all going to be sad because I was quite sad over the Christmas period.
Well, not quite. The basic education minister's basic math was slightly off there. The actual drop was 2.4 percentage points. Down from 2013's pass rate of 78.2%. Officials were quick to use the figures for their own political advantage, with President Jacob Zuma praising the results, but opposition politicians saying that they show serious deficiencies in the education system. The nation's education department has had a difficult ride in recent years, hitting a particularly low point in 2012, when it came to light that the department had failed to deliver 500,000 textbooks to one of the nation's poorer provinces, Limpopo. Motshekga referenced that scandal in Monday night's speech, calling it a delivery delay, and lauding the province for defying those challenges to improve its pass rate this year by 1.1%. The real story behind the results, says education advocate Nombulelo Niatela, is probably somewhere in the middle of those opposing narratives. She is a spokeswoman for the advocacy group Equal Education, and says the matric numbers do not paint a complete picture.
There's a huge focus on the matric results as a yardstick to measure the quality of education in South Africa. And we're saying that it's not an accurate measurement because we have a vast number of other assessments, but we must also use other indicators. We need to be careful about using the matric pass rate as the only indicator for either an improvement in the education system or a decline in the education system.
She says those include things like classroom resources, teacher training, literacy, and numeracy levels, all quantities she encouraged the government to focus on. She also noted that although the education sector receives the lion's share of South Africa's budget, more needs to be invested.
At a broader level, I think that the systemic problems that surround basic education, and that is, for example, the learners that don't have the resources that could possibly make them perform to their optimum. So we definitely need schools with laboratories, schools with libraries, schools with classrooms, adequate-sized classrooms, schools with fences where learners feel secure, schools with adequate teachers so that, you know, teachers are not teaching classes of over 100 learners.
But in the end, she said, she agrees with the minister and the president in sending one important message to the next generation of South African scholars, doctors, engineers, civil servants, lawyers, and, hey, why not, journalists. Congratulations, graduates. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next is our VOA editorial. I'm Hayes Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, John Dryden, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S. Department of Labor has awarded $10 million toward a cooperative agreement with an NGO to implement a project addressing exploitative labor among youth in Ethiopia. The effort, to be conducted with the group World Vision, aims to help vulnerable youth in Ethiopia develop the skills they need to make a successful transition into good jobs. We know when youth are provided skills training and career services that align with needs in the jobs market, they are less likely to be drawn into exploitative labor, Deputy Undersecretary of Labor for International Affairs Carol Pierce said in announcing the award. The project will promote education and vocational training opportunities and seek to enhance livelihoods and access to social protection programs for youth and their households, focusing specifically on the needs of girls. The project aims to address exploitative child labor by providing youth ages 14 to 17 with marketable skills and support to secure decent work. The project will also support President Obama's Young African Leaders Initiative. Since 1993, the ILAB has produced reports to raise awareness globally about child labor and forced labor. ILAB has also provided funding for more than 280 projects in more than 94 countries to combat the worst forms of child labor by providing assistance to vulnerable children and their families. Based in Washington State, World Vision is a nonprofit humanitarian organization conducting relief, development, and advocacy activities in its work with children, families, and their communities in nearly 100 countries to help them reach their full potential by tackling the causes of poverty and injustice. In its 2013 report on human rights practices, the U.S. Department of State noted that the lack of labor inspectors and controls prevented the Ethiopian government from enforcing the law. The resources for inspections and the implementation of penalties were extremely limited. This project builds on the successes of the Ethiopians Fighting Against Child Exploitation project that was also implemented by World Vision in 2011 to 2014.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at voanews.com/editorials.
Hello, I'm Linor Mudu. Please join me live every Tuesday at 17:30 UTC in VOA's health program, Health Chat. Hear from doctors, nurses, international experts discussing the health issues of your concern. Health Chat puts listeners directly in touch with medical professionals. You can talk to them live for free or email your questions. Health Chat brings the medical professionals to your home.